You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where by listening to this podcast, you agree to service us in whatever way we see fit. And that reminds me, we're looking for a third co-host, preferably female, hashtag you too. Not the band. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and if you like our terms of service, leave them a 5-star review on iTunes and tell a friend who would be equally excited to agree to those terms of services. That's how we grow our show. That's how we get serviced more.
Oh.
I want all Harvey Weinstein at the front of this episode.
Watch out. Protect your ficus plants. It's the midside.
Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I just want to take a moment to say that we are an equal opportunity employer. We do not discriminate based on race, sex, religion, or any other protected class.
Just gender.
That being said, if you're not a chick, don't apply.
No, I mean, look, I think it would be helpful to add a female voice to the show. But if it turns out a male host is better for the third host out of everyone who's interested, so be it.
What about a gay man?
Are you just telling me to make William the third host? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. Just the odds are, like, just of, you know, people who might want the job, the odds are it'll be a gay man.
In the history of this show,
the mid-side audience, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Exactly. The history of this show has been very friendly towards the gay male audience, so I don't think that would be a problem. As you just heard, also joining me on this trip, from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
So you've been hearing all this talk of a new host, and it's, in fact, I who will be leaving the show soon. And if you're interested...
James has cancer.
No.
Of the ass.
Of the
because of our notes said that James is a cancer, not has cancer. That's very different. But yes, James cancer something.
But my reasons are is that I am no longer thinking about, paying attention to, or participating in politics at all. And if you want more about that, make sure you keep listening into the last segment of the show.
Look at that. You just did a masterful tease and you want to leave the show. You finally learned how to be a podcast host and now you're leaving.
Yeah, maybe.
All these hours of training we put into you, James, and just getting thrown out the window.
Well, not entirely.
I know. You're going to go on to do whatever.
It just depends.
Write books that change
the
culture.
Mid-side... Yeah.
Whatever. Books.
Well, what I'm hoping to do in this third segment is convince you guys to follow me, to almost go like reverse Galt or something. And if the podcast ends up in sort of the same place I am, where you guys see my reason for bowing out of politics entirely, and you wish to follow me to that area, then I will be back on. So that's a discussion we're going to have later.
The non-existent podcast. Excellent.
I mean, the midside would be a significantly different podcast, but like, that's what I want to discuss, you know.
All right, we'll get there. We'll see.
Stop blowing your load, dude. You're like in the exposition of the porn scene. Like, the girl walked in and is pretending to be your babysitter and you just came already. Like, calm the fuck down.
No, I'm just showing her what is to come.
He's still in fluffer stage, Justin. Don't worry.
We'll get to all of this later. But first, We need Daniel to save us. We need like a real professional to save us with the podcasting right now, because this is pitiful. Please, Daniel, save us as we go into the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Nothing makes for great TV like an autistic CEO being grilled by a bunch of old men. And that's what we got this week, when Mark Zuckerberg was drug in front of Congress and questioned about the Facebooks and all the various things that the social medias do, all the things you can fit into the social medias and whatnot. Yes, Reason.com reports that on Tuesday, the Senate Judiciary and Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committees grilled Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg about the company's insufficient efforts to protect users' personal data. In doing so, many of the senators betrayed a general lack of knowledge about how Facebook operates. Imagine trying to explain social media to your grandparents. This was essentially Zuckerberg's task. For instance, Senator Roy Blunt didn't seem to understand that Facebook lacks a means of accessing information from other apps unless users specifically opt in. The same was true of Senator Roger Wicker, who needed a lot of clarification on how Facebook Messenger interacts with cellular service. Zuckerberg had to carefully explain to Senator Brian Schatz. His name is Brian Schatz? It's terrible. That WhatsApp is encrypted, and that Facebook can't read, let alone monetize, the information people exchange using that service. And Zuckerberg had to explain to multiple senators, including Dean Heller, that Facebook doesn't technically sell its data. Ad companies don't get to see the raw information. Nonetheless, this didn't deter senators whatsoever. They decided, not so much decided as espoused something they had already decided, that Facebook needs to be regulated. In fact, this was my favorite line from Senator Bill Nelson. If Facebook, quote, if Facebook and other online companies will not or cannot fix their privacy invasions, then we are going to have to. We, the Congress. End quote. Justin, I suspect that your grandparents understand Facebook better than many of these senators, who I suspect have outsourced the usage of this tool to intern after intern after intern, whereas your grandparents at least like to comment on photos and then sign their name because they don't know that they have a user profile with their name next to it.
That's so true.
So, Justin, my question for you is, what's up with that?
Sorry, I was just letting James's reaction to that joke sit, because that was a very good laugh. So I just wanted the audience to enjoy that. I'm also trying to figure out how to answer this question, because three out of my four grandparents are dead. And the other one emails me in all caps. So I don't think she knows what Facebook is.
I didn't know your living grandparent was a senator. That's amazing.
I mean, she might as well be. All she does is repeat what's on the afternoon news, and she probably hates Trump. So there you go. I mean, when you say this is like about an autistic person trying to deal with like old people, is this like a subplot on the show The Good Doctor? Because that's what it sounds like to me.
Yes. This is the good social media CEO.
Yeah, the good social media CEO. I mean, it's just, all of this is, when I'm talking about farce, all of this is what I'm talking about when I'm saying farce. Because when you look at both sides who are arguing with each other, I don't even want to say arguing, I don't even know if they're arguing, it's hard to even know what's going on in these discussions. But when I look at both sides, neither of these sides represent rationality or the best of humanity to me. On one hand, you have people who they're saying, oh, we need to regulate no matter what. We need to regulate. That's what their goal is, right? Because that's what their job is. That's what they make their money off of. That's what their life's purpose is to them. And on the other side, we have Mark Zuckerberg, who now he did create a service that we all thought we needed. I would say he probably appealed to the weakest in us, but that's the entire point. Here's somebody who became rich, and as we've said, probably wants to run for president, so he wants to jump across, you know, the table to sit on their side. Although I wonder now, after going through this experience, if he's like, do I really want to do this anymore? But what has he done, really, that's good? He's figured out how to appeal to the worst of us and then turn around and sell our data to other people. I'm not saying he doesn't have the right to. If you click agree and the service says we're going to then sell your data to other people so they can advertise to you or so on and so forth, then you agree to that. I'm just saying that what kind of a person, that's their entire life's work. And how did we let him get that rich? And then finally, just from a pragmatic, practical standpoint, based upon his answers, why haven't we all immediately moved to WhatsApp? If that is the communication app that is encrypted and nobody can see what's going on it, we shouldn't even be texting anymore. We should all just be on WhatsApp.
Alas. Okay, Debbie Downer. Of course, I had to be the one to defend social media. Thanks. It's like when you make me defend Trump. How dare you? I don't think social media has been entirely a net negative thing for the culture. I think it's opened up a communications medium where consumers are more, at least have more access to brands than they would have otherwise, as opposed to having, you know, essentially three television networks that broadcast out constantly. Social media has allowed us to open up all these different content channels for people to share. It's fragmented the market in that sense, but then Welcome to the Midside has an audience, partially because of social media. I don't think we would have in a day before social media. So you thank Mark Zuckerberg for the wild success of this show is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, I'm going to ask you something. I don't disagree with what you're saying in principle, but is that due to Mark Zuckerberg or is that due to Jack at Twitter? And what I mean by that is Twitter came along and made it so people had access to brands, and then Facebook had to change itself, just like Facebook had to change itself to get rid of MySpace too. Facebook was a different thing in the beginning. It wasn't access to brands. So I would argue that it was more Twitter that did that kind of thing, because even if you look at when Facebook bought Instagram, this isn't where I thought we were going to go with this story at all, but whatever. But when Facebook bought Instagram, even Instagram, it's sort of to interact with brands. I mean, I can watch Will Smith's story and see when he's interviewing an astronaut in the International Space Station. But beyond that, it's just people talking about what they do on a daily basis versus Twitter, which originally, before it became about raging about politics, originally was giving people access to brands.
I think you can't have any of it without Facebook. I think Facebook paved the way. Facebook showed that there was a market for it. Facebook opened up people's attitudes to a different kind of interpersonal communication. I think Facebook was a huge innovator in this space, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. I am not as down on Facebook as you are. I think they do some shady things. I think that perhaps we overuse Facebook and social media as a culture, mostly because it's such a new tool that we haven't quite figured out how to properly integrate it into our lives. But I think it's a tool like anything else. I think it can be used for good, bad, nonsense, sense, etc. So,
yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with you, Daniel. Yeah, I don't think there's a case that Facebook is somehow some sort of net negative. And I think Mark Zuckerberg should be lauded for what he gave us. That being said, he's a complete coward.
Yeah.
He's a Stadler. He's someone who's achieved something, but now he just won't stick up for himself, basically, is what it comes down to. And I have no respect for him now.
It's true. I
don't think we shouldn't be regulated. Yeah. What's that?
I really wish he had gone like Hank Reardon and been like, I don't recognize the legitimacy of this committee.
Yeah.
What are you going to do to me?
I mean, what are they going to do to him? I mean, the answer is they can do certain things to him, but all of those things involve not being able to maybe follow through on these political aspirations he has. And I think, you know, those political aspirations he has betrays his corruption. I don't know exactly what corruption it betrays, but it does, because I just don't think an honest man can want to get into politics. What's that?
That's an argument for a different day, but I'll let that one slide by for now. Except this
But I have to admit this theater of senators saying like, so is it true, Mr. Zuckerberg, that you can send over 3 internets to someone per day? Shouldn't we just regulate it down to 2 internets per day that you can send a single person? You know, like. the theater of a man like Zuckerberg, someone just very straightforward and all business and very like legitimately committed to his job, talking with the joke of these people. That sort of theater that tempts me to get back into the farce, I have to admit.
Yeah. Justin, did you learn anything from this, from these hearings?
If I say no, that makes for a really bad pod, but I don't know. I don't know how to say yes. Are you asking that question because you learned something? I mean, I learned that I hate all these people even more than I realize. Like, but beyond that, no. What did you learn? Anything?
No, I didn't really. I didn't. Maybe it's just naivete. I understand that there's a certain level of non-thinking that goes into politics. There's a certain level of power lusting, and there's a certain level of being immune to hypocrisy. But all that being said, when it's so blatant and in your face, you would think that at least someone in their staff would tap them on the shoulder before they said things like, "The American people don't like to be spied on, Mr. Zuckerberg." Someone should tap them on the shoulder and be like, "Prism, Edward Snowden, we've been through this, don't say that out loud." But there's not even that person anymore. It's just blatant, in your face, "I don't care if I'm consistent, I don't care if I'm principled, we do not give a crap anymore whatsoever. We can just say whatever we want because we are post-truth, we are post-modern." So,
well, that was almost thing about as though it. The political discussion is over.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that statement, James, because everyone thinks now, everyone thinks that they, or he or she, whatever, or Z, whatever fucking pronoun, whatever singular pronoun you want to use, it's very important that it's singular. I want to be clear about that. Every person believes that he or she or Z is the champion of the people. So they project all of their beliefs and values onto every other human being. So when that woman was saying, sorry, I don't want to assume her gender. When that person was saying that the American people do not want to be spied on, Z was saying that Z did not, I can't do this. She was saying that she didn't want to be spied on. That's all that was going on. And that's where this sanctimoniousness comes from, because everybody thinks they have the moral high ground now. Everyone thinks they're the one fighting for the people. And that's why I was saying, like, both of these sides, like, Mark Zuckerberg thinks he's the representative of the people, and they think they're the representative of the people. But none of them actually represent any of us, because they don't ask us what we think. And I mean, how fucked up is it that Facebook, rather than just simply asking us things, mines our data? And what I mean by that is, if I happen to, on a whim, go search for something on eBay, I then get that advertised to me for the next 3 weeks as if that's what I want.
Careful what you search for.
Well, yeah. How about this? Have you ever, like, in a conversation with your girlfriend online, have her send you something, and then that becomes what shows up in your searches for the next month? And what I mean by that is one of her friends got engaged early in our relationship, and she sent me, like, the site that the girl bought the ring from, because it's, like, this organic hippie site or something. I don't know. Like, "Oh, make sure your diamonds are non-conflict, and here's a wooden box that's made from recycled wood." It's like, I'm going to buy a conflict diamond. I'm going to make sure as many child soldiers were killed. No, it's just... They have all these, but then that site would then pop up, and engagement rings would pop up on Facebook for the next month to 2 months for me. So it's like,
do you get a discount if you have to wipe off the blood yourself from the diamond? If you have to clean it yourself? Yeah.
I would like to point out that recycled wood, that's called particle board. You're giving your fiance a particle board box for your engagement ring. Just wanna clarify that.
Right. Right, you can make the actual ring part out of rebar, and then just sort of complete the circle, literally.
Just go to the site and look at it. But my point is that even Facebook, even though they claim to know us and they claim to be selling our personal information, you know, unless you do the thing where you click in and it lets them see where you're going all the time and all that kind of stuff, it's not really you. It's it's a digital representation. So we've got two groups of people arguing with each other that don't really represent us. And then they wonder why Trump got elected, because Trump pretended to represent people. That's all he did. He went, you guys are all fucking out there acting like you know shit and you're connected to people and you're not. And I'm just going to pretend I am. And everyone bought it. And now we're here.
And now Ann Coulter is sad.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. I retweeted that where she was like, not one of your promises has come true. And I just retweeted that with the crying laughing emoji because it's the funniest shit ever.
Oh, Ann Coulter.
Oh, that wall. Yes.
Yeah, it's funny. They're building a wall. We were driving on a highway today where they were building this wall, basically a soundproof barrier. And I just thought to myself, like, huh, I didn't think the border wall would be so close to D.C., but makes sense. If we had to build a wall, it would be around the district so that they couldn't get out. That would really be my dream. But other than that, we're not going to build walls. We're not going to do any of that. We're going to take away people's knives, at least in London. That's the plan of Mayor Sadiq Khan, who has called for sharper knife control after the murder rate in London has surpassed the murder rate of New York City for the first time. Khan tweeted, "No excuses. There is never a reason to carry a knife. Anyone who does will be caught, and they will feel the full force of the law."
Damn.
Except that the police officers won't have guns or knives to arrest you, so they'll be stabbed to death. Okay. Because there's no good reason to carry a knife, by the way. So, police officers shouldn't have them either. There have been more than 50 homicides in London so far in 2018, and much of the violence is tied to gangs. Guns are strictly regulated in the UK, and the rising homicide rate in London is directly attributable to a rise in knife-related crimes, with stabbings claiming at least 31 lives to date in 2018. By contrast, New York, which has a population roughly the same size as London, has seen a steady decline in violent crime. Justin, once they take away the knives, what will be the murder weapon of choice?
I don't know. Your fist? Like, you can strangle people still, right? And, like, you can break their necks and things?
Well, then we're going to need to register your hands like they're a lethal weapon. Like in all good westerns.
Yeah, like Chuck Norris, right? That's called the Chuck Norris Bill?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, when he said that you're going to feel the full force of the law, that's a line I use in roleplay sometimes.
And believe me, justice isn't blind.
I mean, even the language of this article, right? I mean, you heard James laugh about it at the top, like, oh, the sharp increase in what was it?
Sharper knife control.
Sharper knife control. Okay. First of all, just reading that or just hearing it, you could be like, oh, so he's only outlawed the sharpest knives, so I can carry around a dull knife? So it's a headline that tries to be smart, but then comes across as stupid, which is then the whole article. Because something else you said in there shows how biased our language is and how biased our thought is. It said the rise in violent crime is directly attributable to knife crimes. Did it say that?
No. The rising rate is directly attributable to gangs.
Read the quote. That's not what you said.
I did say that. You didn't listen. Thank you. Okay. There have been more than 50 homicides in London so far in 2018, and much of the violence is tied to gangs.
Yes. Okay, keep going.
Guns are strictly regulated in the United Kingdom, and the rising homicide rate in London is directly attributable to a rise in knife-related crimes.
That's it. That's what I'm saying. The rising homicide rate in London is directly attributable to a rise in knife-related crimes. That's not the proper use of the word attributable.
It's true.
That's like saying the knife-related crimes are what are causing the homicides. No, that's the method of the homicide. Even speaking about that, you're talking about the tool, not the person doing it. No, the rise in homicide rate is directly related or attributable to the number of people committing homicide.
It's true.
It's even writing
in that way.
If more
people commit homicides, you will have more homicides.
Right. But they're somehow blaming it on that's the fact that they're choosing that. Isn't that the question? That is the question they should be asking. Why are suddenly they choosing to kill with knives? Oh, is it because they outlawed guns?
Right.
What?
Why are they choosing to kill? Why?
Right, that's it.
No matter whether it's a gun, it's a knife, or the also, by the way, horrific rise in acid attacks in London. Why is one human being deciding to take any weapon, any instrument whatsoever, and murder another human being with it? Who gives a crap if you're murdered by a gun or a knife? What is causing the rise in human beings to want to kill other human beings?
It's the knife crimes. It's the knife. It's directly attributable to the knife crimes, Daniel.
Ooh, look, shiny. I'm going to stab this in someone's throat. It's not really how knives work, at least in my experience with
because
knives,
you obviously are not dealing with sharper knives.
Yeah. Sadiq Khan is walking through a mall and he's triggered by the sharper image store. Like, no, duller image. Yeah. James, what the hell's going on here?
Well, it's almost as though people are so confused about these sorts of political issues that they're unable to get anywhere close to thinking about the issue clearly. And you would have to fundamentally alter their way of thinking about it on a deep, deep level to even get them to start to actually think about the issue.
He's already setting up his argument for the third segment here. Like, this is...
Yeah, I mean, like, now that I'm kind of being, you know, made to look at the news again, now that I've decided to not, I'm seeing the reasons for why I'm not looking at the news anymore.
Yeah.
This is the deeper question that I want answered. Why do you think people are killing more now in London? What is it about London culture, London psychology, that's making those people kill more?
Murder rates are declining in New York. So whatever that culture is, we're not importing it.
Well, that's why I said London culture. I was very clear about that. So why do you think New Yorkers aren't killing as much? And why do you think Londoners are?
I don't know. It's a good question.
I don't know, but that's the right question to ask. But as it stands now, no one is really able to ask it.
I just asked it.
No. I mean, like, my point is that generally the question isn't being asked. Like, that's the right question to ask. I don't know the answer, but it's the right question to ask. But I think the interesting issue to me is that people can't answer or even understand that question anymore. They're focused on some kind of concrete, like a knife.
Because Sadiq Khan would keep screaming over and over again because they're using knives, and he would be confused as to why that doesn't satisfy the answer to your question.
Yeah.
He'd be confused. He keeps saying because they use knives, that's why there are more murders.
Yeah, and I'm sure that over the course of history, most people are too concrete bound to actually deal with a problem like that. Like, most people throughout history were always so concrete bound that it's like they couldn't get past the fact that there's a knife involved or there's a gun involved. And like, only the concretes are apparent to them. But throughout history, intellectuals have been our rulers, and so they're able to deal with these problems. They're like, okay, well, it's not literally the knife or literally the gun, so what's the problem? And they think about it in terms of abstractions. Our intellectuals don't think in terms of abstractions anymore, at least not in terms of at least not in the field of politics. So
I don't think any of us are particularly qualified to answer your question, Justin, but could we give sort of broad categories for the types of answers that might be given? So, like, in my mind, it might be something, what increases hostility between people? So, one, there could just be more people, right? You can have more murders because there are more people, mm-hmm. and you don't have an increased murder rate. That doesn't, you know, it's not really answered in the article. It could be that there are more clashes between people who traditionally don't like each other, maybe clashes of different cultures, for instance.
You went there second. Interesting.
There
I agree.
Could be an economic element to this. I don't know if the UK or London in general is getting richer or poorer overall, but as poverty increases, violence tends to increase. So that could be an answer. I'm not saying any of these are the answer. I'm saying these are the sorts of broad categories that we could, I don't know, explore, talk about, fundamentally.
Well,
a couple
other things that I would add to what you're saying. We've tracked interpersonal hostility on here. and just the general rise in interpersonal hostility. I have always said that London is ahead of us as sort of a dying empire, and we see where social justice culture is leading us. So I think there's elements of that in there as well. And then to sort of go the Jordan Peterson route, you're teaching people about relativism and you're saying there is no truth, everything's relative, it's just about, you know, what different people's experiences are, and that pushes things more towards chaos, people are going to lash out in a way to try and bring order back to their own lives. And maybe this is the way they think they can bring about order into their own lives, where they're killing the sources of chaos, if you combine it with the interpersonal hostility. So I do think there's something to be said for preaching relativism and social justice, and also the idea of as things become more chaotic, people are going to find ways to lash out.
We should get Jordan Peterson on this show. He's got nothing going on, right?
I mean, I just impersonated him. I just said order versus chaos, and it fueled culture. That's pretty much everything he says, isn't it?
It's true. If you had a slightly more Canadian accent, I would have just been totally convinced he was here right now.
Yes. And lobsters and the Virgin
That's
Mary
right,
and Marduk.
You know, you make fun of the lobster thing, but I've read like over half of his book, and so far the lobster chapter has been the best chapter. So
seriously?
Yeah, it doesn't get better after the first couple chapters, certainly. So, you know, it does get better. Apparently the Simpsons, at least in their response to the whacked culture in which we live. Simpsons was the target of a documentary last year about Apu, the Indian American owner of Springfield's Quickie Mart. The documentary, which is called The Problem with Apu, argues that the character is a racist stereotype, and that it is problematic to have that kind of character in a show because it normalizes the stereotyping and whatnot. But it turns out that the creators of The Simpsons don't particularly care about this criticism. At least that's what it would seem in their on-air response in an episode a few weeks ago. Essentially, what was happening in the episode is Marge was re-editing one of Lisa's favorite bedtime stories, The Princess in the Garden, to eliminate stereotypes of Irishmen and American Southerners and recast the protagonist as a cisgender girl who releases horses and fights net neutrality. Lisa, who is sort of the show's resident leftist or social justice warrior, whatever you want to call it, sort of waves off Marge's modern update, saying she understood the context of the story and that she was fine with it the way it was. She says, quote, "Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?" Lisa says, as Lisa and Mom look at the camera, and it pans over to a picture of Apu written on it, "Don't have a cow, man." Of course, the documentary director and the sort of general outrage left on the internet is, you guessed it, outraged. Wonder what gave that away. The documentary filmmaker said in a tweet, "Wow, politically incorrect? That's the takeaway from my movie and the discussion it sparked? Man, I really love this show. This is sad." Warriors Kamu Bell said, "I think the fact that they put this argument in the mouth of Lisa's character, the character who usually champions the underdogs and is supposed to be the most thoughtful and liberal, is what makes this the most ridiculous, as it is worthy of ridicule and toothless response." Other people said essentially that the show is dead, they won't be watching. I'm sure HuffPo called for a boycott, although I haven't seen it yet. Justin, does this raise the level of respect in your mind for The Simpsons?
This isn't the first time they've done something like this, correct? Didn't they do an episode last season where they went to college and went after the college social justice warriors?
Yeah, they did a show. They did an episode where Montgomery Burns goes back to Yale and finds it to be this social justice hellhole, and so he refuses to give them any more money.
Yeah, and it was very critical of the social justice movement on campus and all of the things we sort of lampooned on the show where, you know, they got upset about the Halloween costumes and they're supposed to give them a safe place to live, and they didn't, all of that. Remember when they, was it Yale, where they were all yelling at the person who, I don't remember who it was, but the school official was supposed to help them with their dorm life?
Probably the headmaster, and then they wanted his title changed as well. Yeah,
something like that. That's funny.
Yes.
The headmaster. Yeah, and they want to change because the master. Yeah, so this is not a surprise to me from The Simpsons. But what it is, to me, is very comforting. Because it shows that all my fears that we are going to go as far as English culture or European culture may not be founded. For years, The Simpsons, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, was a bastion of leftism. But now, we're starting to see, and I said this with the Oscars too, and how the Oscars got such a poor reception and so few people seeing it. Sorry, I got a text and I got distracted. With so few people, exactly, shiny and sharp.
I'm gonna stab this into someone's neck.
With so few people seeing the Oscars, we're starting to see the backlash against social justice. And the fact that the left would be able to lampoon it and see how absurd it is, because I don't even feel the need to talk about how absurd these people are being about this whole Apu thing. If you listen to the show, you know why. And if you're an intelligent person, you know why they're being absurd. The main critique I've seen is that it's a white person, Hank Azaria, voicing Apu, which is taking jobs away from Indians, which is absurd. But the fact that the Simpsons and people on the left are seeing social justice as absurd, that's a victory. And that gives me a lot of hope that maybe we've seen the bottom of the barrel now.
It's almost as if one of the best ways to fight these people is to laugh at them. James.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, you have to stand up for yourself. Yeah. And I'm glad to see them doing that. And that's good. I think this is one of the issues where you can win by standing up for yourself. I mean, you can always win by standing. You always get ahead by standing up for yourself. That's not the part of politics I'm against. But at the end of the day, by standing up for yourself, are you communicating the set of ideas that are required to back people out of these misconceptions? No, you're just protecting yourself, which is fine and you must do it. But you aren't moving the culture forward by doing it. You're slowing its collapse, which, again, is fine, but it's not a primary. So
Every
single thing I could almost sort of give an example like and set. I'm almost setting up my case for this whole thing for this third segment. So, yeah.
I mean, I wonder, James, and maybe we'll get into this in the third segment more, like if I used a war metaphor with you. Now, I'm not good with guns in particular. Uh-huh. I know there are guns that shoot a lot of bullets and guns that shoot not as many bullets. And that's about the extent of my gun knowledge.
All right.
In movies, they put silencers on them and they're very cool. Okay.
Right.
But
those are cool.
In a war, you don't have like one type of infantry or one type of soldier to win the war, right? You have a bunch of different kind of specialists who win the war. Mm. You have snipers and you have, my God, how back am I going? Bombardiers. And you have infantrymen and you have guys on horses with scimitars.
Cavalry.
There you go. Etc. And you don't expect one type of attack is going to win the war. You expect there's going to be a series of battles, and maybe there's one type of people who are just the archers to sort of hold back some people, and then there's the people who go forward and actually engage with the enemy. I am horrible with war metaphors, but I think you understand where I'm going with this.
No, it's a great metaphor. Like, that may be the case. That's something more to talk about. But something I'll say for my own case is I'm not cavalry. I'm not infantry. I'm not even a general. I'm a physicist. And I intend on inventing a nuclear bomb to settle war once and for all.
Oh. Or you could be a Pythagoras and you can literally just pick up the boats.
Oh, that was Archimedes, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, but Archimedes, like,
I mean,
yes.
Yeah, but, and that metaphor runs deeper than you may expect, at least I hope, so.
All right. Justin, are you going to give The Simpsons a shot this season? I've been watching.
That's a larger discussion for me about, like, why I don't really find myself wanting to watch much television shows in general anymore. I mean, I find myself, I watch shows and then like I'll catch up on them and I'll go, why am I watching these shows again? And if I got into The Simpsons, it would just be another thing. It's like another commitment. Here's something else I have to watch. It's like, why am I watching this again? Because something that happened with The Simpsons is something that's happening with most television now is, at least for me, every show has like a couple good things that are interesting each episode and are worthwhile each episode. But then for most of the 22 minute runtime, I'm just like, why am I watching this? I just watched 22 minutes for 3 minutes of entertainment. And that's what The Simpsons would be for me. Like, I don't have to be a general. I don't have to be a tight end who blocks and catches passes to appreciate a tight end who's just blocking. Or I don't have to be a fan of The Simpsons to appreciate what they just did and say thank you and then move on to do other things with my life. I don't even have to engage highly with entertainment anymore if that's my choice. I'm not saying that is my choice. I'm just saying that there are ways of appreciating what's going on overall and being aware without letting that be a huge part and a huge influence of your on your life. And that's what I feel like. Some tight ends, and Daniel, I'm taking your war metaphor and I'm making it a football metaphor. Some tight ends,
slightly
like
slightly gay one, but yes,
like Rob Gronkowski, are going to catch footballs like that and make ridiculous passes and also block. But then some tight ends, like Dwayne Allen, you only sign them to block, and you can appreciate both of their contributions, and both of them are necessary to win. And you need everyone to buy into no days off and doing your job. And when I see The Simpsons buying in, even if I'm never going to watch the show, and I don't know if the rest of the people are there, even if they're only Dwayne Allen and we don't have a Rob Gronkowski culturally yet, I can still appreciate that, hey, we've got Dwayne Allen, which is something.
I think we need more Brady's and Belichick's than Gronkowski's in the culture. But yes, your point is well taken, I think. Great. Time to depress you all. We'll probably move through this one pretty quickly, I think, because there's nothing much to say except... wow. So here it is. A survey of millennials showed that 4 in 10 don't know 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. In fact, more than one-fifth of millennials in the U.S., 22%, haven't heard of or aren't sure if they've heard of the Holocaust, according to a study published Thursday on Israel's Holocaust Remembrance Day. Additionally, 41% of millennials believe 2 million Jews or fewer were killed during the Holocaust, the study found. In fact, 6 million Jews were killed. Two-thirds of millennials could not identify in the survey what Auschwitz was. So basically, to me, these types of sort of general awareness surveys, one, there is some caution to be had because we live in the troll culture. So who knows, especially if young people are answering these questions correctly.
That's a good point.
But let's assume that it's, you know, even some majority percentage of these people don't actually know what the Holocaust is. To me, all these kind of stories are one thing, which is an indictment of the government school system, which should be abolished immediately, burned to the ground, and just scooped away into the dustbin of history of bad ideas. So... Justin, did you take anything else from this article?
Yeah, I mean, the education point is well taken, and it leads to something. It leads to what I talked about last episode with that fucking tour guide in Berlin who goes from America and goes to Berlin and starts saying those things. If you don't properly teach what the threat was, what the outcome was of the Holocaust and what the threat was of Nazism, you are not going to be able to identify potential problems in the future. And that's how we end up where we are now. These kids, not just kids, our culture has no sense of, because we're in our little American bubble, and I love America. We saw this last episode. If any of you fucking have a problem, go back and listen to the Eurotrip edition. If you have any problem with what I'm about to say, go back and listen to the Eurotrip edition. But because we're in this bubble in America, we have no sense of the history, the tragedies that have befallen the world, and what happens when you don't? You repeat it. And that is what we are on the precipice of doing if we're not careful. I don't know how close we are or not. That would be a Jordan Peterson question about where are we in the order chaos balance, right? He might say we're more towards chaos. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. But the point is, when these kids don't know these things, it makes it easier for them to happen again. Because if you're saying Trump is literally Hitler, well, then what happens when literally Hitler comes? I mean, there was a comment that I shared with you, Midsider Michael and Midsider Morgan Daniel. And this was on Instagram. And this was if we were still doing the dick pic, the dumb internet comment of the week segment, I would have picked this. And it was on Instagram. Somebody was saying Thanos from the new Avengers movie, Avengers Infinity War, what his backstory was. And his backstory is essentially that his entire planet was going to die. So his suggestion was they randomly kill half the population of the planet so the planet won't like implode and they won't stop, you know, using the environmental resources. And so people, of course, were like, you're a madman, and they kicked him out. But then, of course, the planet imploded. So because he's so bitter about what happened, his goal is to go around the universe and randomly kill half the population of every planet in order to save the planets from destruction. Now, as far as writing, that's good writing. It's good writing because the villain has an understandable goal, and it makes sense to the villain that that is a good thing to do. Even though it's pure evil, it makes sense to the villain that it's a good thing to do. But it's obviously pure evil to anyone who knows anything about the world and history. I mean, it sounds very much like the Holocaust. But then, of course, somebody in the comment section says, he actually sounds like kind of a good guy. How fucked up do you have to be? How low of an education do you have to have? How low IQ do you have to be? And when I say fucked up, I mean psychologically, philosophically. Do you have to be, in order to read that description of that backstory, that he randomly goes around and kills the random half of any population of any planet? How fucked up do you have to be to read that and go, oh yeah, he sounds like kind of a good guy?
The guy's probably a professor at Berkeley. Let's be serious.
Honestly, I couldn't understand what you said. Could you repeat it?
The audience is going to get it because we separately record microphones. Just know that when I say something, you laugh hysterically and we move on. That's how the show works.
There was dead air, though, and nobody was picking it up, so I had to fill it by...
I said the guy is likely a professor at Berkeley. Let's be serious.
Yeah.
No.
And that, but it just, this is what bothers me because... I, you know, was just there, and I saw all this stuff. Berkeley. And I mean, what about all the non-Jews that were killed in the Holocaust? I mean, how many Japanese people were killed in World War II? Like, how do you forget all of these things and their effect on world history? It's just, it's awful. Awful.
James, do you want to crap on American school systems before we move on?
Frankly, I'm surprised that this many people do know about it. To be the opposite as usual, these numbers sound like a success to me. Like, look at how many people did know about the Holocaust. Like, look at how many people did know that aspect of history. Even accounting for the how crappy our school systems are, like, at least they know. I mean, it seems like, you know, these foundations that really focus on thinking about the Holocaust and stuff like that, they've gotten the word out. A lot of people know about it. We have a cultural awareness of these atrocities, which is I think it's not the end all be all, but I mean it's something worth imprinting upon our psyches as a culture. And it sounds like they've done a pretty damn good job looking at these numbers.
So. All credit, in my mind, goes to Family Guy, who does at least one Nazi episode a season. So.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, well, do you guys want to talk about something else that's going to depress you?
Always. It's what I live for.
That's the right answer. That's why we have this show. It's not to witness the farce. It's to witness the depression. So let's do that in... The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
People viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio.
focused on.
Guys, I saw a Tyler Perry movie.
Yeah.
Now, Daniel, you're the one who I think previously on the show said Tyler Perry movies aren't as bad as people say they are.
My point being simply that, yeah, they're not Shakespeare, but they also don't, he's not making them out to be Shakespeare. They're competently written and amusing. And if you just want something to sort of sit down and enjoy that's lighthearted, you will enjoy a Tyler Perry movie. Don't crap on it.
Okay, well, maybe it's because this movie wasn't intended to be lighthearted. It's a serious drama. But I saw Acrimony, and I would not describe it as competent at all.
Oh.
I was very disappointed because I thought this would be a very good role for Tahiri Henson. I can never say her first name. How do you say her first name? Taraji? I don't know how to say it. Henson. She's an excellent actress. I'm waiting for her to get a really big movie role. Remember, we talked about this with Proud Mary. I'm waiting for her to get a really big movie role where she gets Oscar nominated, where she becomes the big movie star she deserves to be. Because even in this, she does the best she can with the material. But this movie, everything you've heard about Tyler Perry is true. It is incompetently written. And the directing, though there are times where I'm like, oh, okay, he's trying. And he was trying throughout the movie, but the directing, let me put it this way. There are many scenes that are obviously just shot in front of a green screen. That's how poorly the green screening is done. Also, the entire climax takes place on a boat, and it's very obvious by how it's shot that this boat is just in one of those studio water tanks. Do you know what I mean when they don't even go out to the ocean? They just set up a water tank in their studio and put a boat on it and simulate it like it's water?
That sounds expertly produced.
Yes, and that's the thing, is it's, none of it is done that way. So what is the movie about then, or what is it trying to be about? This is where, ultimately, I'm surprised this isn't more of a controversial movie. So the movie is about Henson's character who, at the beginning, is told by a judge that she has to do mandatory therapy because she has anger issues because she keeps harassing her ex-husband and his new wife. And she says to her therapist, "No one understands my story. Nobody believes me, basically, that she has my life that I deserve." So the whole movie starts out when they're in college, they meet. He cheats on her, then they get together, and he's trying to invent a battery that always stays charged. And she gets money, inheritance money from her mother, and she basically keeps him afloat, and to the point that they've run out of money, they're in debt. The family tries to help them, so the mother's house that was also left to her doesn't get foreclosed on. He fucks up, and the mother's house is lost. They lose their business, which they were trying to leverage to keep the mother's house. And the whole time she's narrating this in therapy, saying how, oh, look how manipulative he is. Look how he's making me use my money and use my money and so on and so forth. And then it gets to the end of the therapy. And this is before the end of the movie. And it gets to the end of the therapy. And the therapist says to her, "Have you ever heard of borderline personality disorder?" So this was Tyler Perry's attempt to do a serious portrayal of borderline personality disorder and the way it affects people. He kept talking about how in the movie that, you know, she would go into these angry rages where she couldn't control herself and they were different than other people's angry rages. But at the beginning of the movie, it was framed as, you know, you've heard all the stereotypes of black women and how jealous they get and how their anger is insane. Well, I'm not one of those people, and I want to tell you why. But then at the end, she has borderline personality disorder, and the entire movie ends with her murdering her ex-husband on his boat with his new fiance, and she gets killed as well. The anchor is tied around her ankle, and she gets pulled off the boat. So I'm actually surprised people aren't offended at this movie, because accidentally, Tyler Perry linked borderline personality disorder with the jealous and rage issues of a jealous female. So he's basically called every jealous black female, because this was very clearly intended as a black movie, because it's Tyler Perry. I mean, that's what he does, right? And at the beginning, it was framed, like I said, that's what it was framed as, you know, the stereotype. That's what people say about it. He claimed that he very clearly framed it as, whether on purpose or not, that they all have borderline personality disorders. So jealous black females are insane. That's basically what he's saying with this movie. Now, I want to be very clear that he's saying this accidentally, because this movie is so incompetently made. So this battery, right? This is basically Galt's invention, is it not, from Atlas Shrugged?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he succeeds in inventing it, and he becomes mega rich, and he works with this company. But it is not shown how this changes the world at all or anything. Life as usual just continues, and then he just ends up murdered on a yacht. So it's like, none of the, it's just everything he writes is like, he writes very pragmatically. Like, I don't think Tyler Perry does multiple drafts, Daniel. I really think he sits down with a premise and he writes, and then he gets to a problem and he goes, okay, how do I get out of this? And then he writes his way out of it, and he doesn't go back to look at how it looks at as a cohesive whole. I mean, at one point, her family, you know, her two sisters and their husbands, invite over her ex-husband and his new wife to say, okay, our sister's really crazy. When you guys get married, make sure you have security there. So, of course, who shows up to their house? Henson, their sister. Why in the year 2018 do you need to have that scene? Why can't you just call them? Why can't you call his head of security and say that? But no, it was a contrived scene in order to create artificial drama. I don't even want to just keep bashing on it, because I kind of feel bad. I kind of feel like it's picking on the kid with the helmet on the bus. Like, that's what I feel like. Wow. I don't even have contempt for it. I feel bad for it. Like, after the movie, yeah, my girlfriend was trying to understand it, right? Because she wanted to see this movie about, like, you know, the Carrie Underwood song about before he cheats, like digging the keys into the side of his pretty little four-wheel drive. You know, the whole idea that, like, maybe next time he'll think before he cheats. She wanted a song, or she wanted a movie about that. And it starts out with that, because as we know from dealing with someone with borderline personality disorder, they always make it seem like the other person is the bad guy. That is what they do. And through the whole movie, you're on that path. But then as the movie continues, you're like, wait, this guy's actually a really nice guy, and he's working really hard, and he's really smart, and he's trying. Wait, there's something wrong with her. But you're waiting for the shoe to fall and to find out that she's not actually crazy, because it was framed as, hey, I'm not crazy, and she's the protagonist. So, on one hand, Tyler Perry is taking almost a Alfred Hitchcockian risk, wherein, you know, Psycho, he kills the main character partway through the movie, and here he's saying that his main character is actually the villain, but at the same time, it's a very poor structure, because you can't set up the main character going, I'm going to show you why I'm sympathetic, and then make the main character non-sympathetic. It just doesn't work with the audience. So my girlfriend was trying to cure that cognitive dissonance that Tyler Perry created in her head, and I'm like, you can't. She was crazy. And she's like, no, but I wanted it to be that he was the cheater and she was justified, and it just doesn't make sense. Like, I was waiting. Like, what if the whole movie was just in her head, and the whole time she thought she was with him, but she really wasn't? That would make the movie make sense. And I was like, you're trying to make a movie make sense that is about a crazy person and is just nonsensical in general. I was like, they didn't use cell phones in the movie except to track people. It doesn't make sense, Christine. So
Tyler Perry's next movie is going to be a murder mystery where they spend the first 20 minutes proving it's not the butler, and then at the end it's the butler.
That's pretty much, yeah, like 100%. Yeah. That's what I would expect. It's, look, good on Tyler Perry. That, I mean, he made $35 million on this movie already. I doubt it cost very much money to produce. 90% of the budget had to have gone, and I don't know what the budget was, but 90% of the budget had to have gone to the actors. Because, I mean, like I said, he's green screen and shit. He's got his studio in Atlanta, where he's got the water tank and the yacht set up. So this was shot on a shoestring budget. So good on Tyler Perry for somehow finding an audience and being able to make money on this shit, but you shouldn't see this. It's not even, honestly, I felt bad for Henson that she was in this movie and she put her career in his hands and he did this to her. So
watch a Madea movie.
Do you think she may murder him like later at his house?
You shouldn't watch this movie, and you should watch a Madea movie. Is that the takeaway?
There you go. Madea saves Christmas.
Madea saves Tyler Perry should be the movies. He plays Madea, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on to talking shit about some other stuff.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Ocean's 8 is the all-female reboot of Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12. Reboot, side sequel? I don't really know. So it stars Sandra Bullock, who plays the sister of Danny Ocean. I've never actually seen Ocean's 11. I don't know if either of you have and can comment on it. Mm-hmm. But the basic premise of this is she's been in jail for 5 years, 8 months, 12 days, or whatever the fucking number was she said in there. And during that, she has devised a plan to steal a $150 million necklace from the neck of Anne Hathaway, who apparently is playing a very naive woman in this movie, it seemed from the beginning of the trailer. I'm not sure. But this is the question that I hope the movie answers. And maybe it's because it's the Met, and because it's the Met Gala or whatever, it has to be women. But there needs to be a reason that it's only women who can participate in this heist. It's the same thing with the Ghostbusters movie. Well, I don't think there will be either, James. I don't. But that's what there needs to be. Just like with the Ghostbusters movie, where it's like, why was it only women? Just for the sake of making it women? Now, again, if you guys have seen the other ones, you can tell me if there are women involved in that heist. Because, again, there's no reason when you're robbing a casino that it should be only men robbing it. And, in fact, if you're robbing a casino, I would think you would want women on your team. So, for all I'm saying here, there's going to be no reason I'm ever going to see this movie, especially because Mindy Kaling is in this movie and I fucking can't stand her. So for me, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Daniel?
Tackle Oceans 8 through Infinity.
Tackle.
You didn't like Oceans Infinity, 11, Daniel?
I don't like any of these kind of movies. It's probably not a bad movie. It doesn't do it for me. And certainly reboots that try to make a social justice point, I don't care about. Ocean's Infinity, by the way, is where one half of the population of the Earth tries to steal 100% of the assets from the other half of the population of the Earth. It's a thrill ride through and through.
James?
That's a movie?
No.
No, he was making a joke. Wow. It's sort of how, like, 28 days later.
Wow. That took me a while to figure out the sheer mathematics of that joke.
Right. It's just like how 28 days later is eventually going to be like 28 centuries later, where they're just living in peace and it's like not about zombies at all. Yeah.
Yeah. It just upends the premise. The premise just ends up being about units of time that come in 28s. That's just the premise of the series.
Right.
28 epochs later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't, this looked dumb. One thing I'll note that goes beyond what you guys have said already is it just me, or do movies like this, where they're trying to like force something on you, especially when they're trying to force feminism on you, they have this kind of artificial humor. I don't know how else to put it. Or maybe that's just Sandra Bullock humor. It's like, I feel like the joke is being like forced on me. Like, you're supposed to laugh now. I don't know. Do you guys get that feeling at all from Sandra Bullock in this preview?
That's how I feel about 99% of comedies that are out nowadays.
It's as if they filmed it with Sandra Bullock and a live studio audience for a laugh track, and then took out the laugh track. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, or I hate to say this, but it's true. Have you ever seen female, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but have you ever seen female comics that haven't made it yet? I know this is really specific. You can tell they go on stage. I mean, I've watched a fair amount of stand-up because my friend is a stand-up comedian, and a fair number of females go up, and the ones that you can tell, there's certain ones that are fine. They're trying to be funny, like, and they're up there doing their best. But other ones, it's like you can tell that they're only given the time of day because they're hot, and they seem to somehow, like, there's something implicit in the way they're telling the jokes that it's like, it's your duty to laugh at me. I don't have to be funny because you're supposed to laugh at me. That's what this felt like.
James, yeah. Women are totally smart and funny, James.
Well, some of them are funny, like, but I mean, but not Sandra Bullock.
He's just sidestepped the
smart. But not smart.
Well, nobody answered my question. Were there women involved in the heist in Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12?
I don't remember if there was. There was like two.
Yeah, my question to you, Justin, to be the social justice warrior devil's advocate, would be, did Ghostbusters have a give a reason why it was all men?
Yeah, because men were the ones who had jobs and ran most of society at the time.
The 80s?
I mean, it's look, like it's not humor, perfect, but like that's
kind of...
What?
What?
And it may have been... It may contribute to, like, bro humor to have an all-male cast like that, if that's what you're going for.
I mean, nowadays it would contribute to bro humor, definitely. But I think then it was just the holdover from the way the culture used to be. I mean, I don't want to start going into, like, gender discussions and everything about that. Like, James, just tell me if it was a tackle or not.
Oh, I said tackle.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
Okay.
I just can't eloquently tackle. At this point explain what I'm trying to say. Do you understand what I'm trying to say at all, Daniel?
Yes, but I may not agree 100%, but I get what you're trying to say. Yes.
All right, do you really want to shit on the original Ghostbusters? Is that what we're going to do here?
No, I love the original Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Second trailer.
American Animals is about a bunch of stupid kids who think they can pull off a heist and then try to pull off the heist. Now, in this trailer, it says, not based on a true story, this actually happened. So I don't know if they somehow went back to the past and filmed what happened, because then it always has to be based on a true story. But here's the problem with this trailer. I did a little bit of reading about this movie, and this is the kind of movie that they just don't know how to cut a trailer for. Because actually, I guess this movie is a hybrid. And it's a hybrid fiction and documentary. So it's sort of like those shows on the Learning Channel where it's like, my wedding was destroyed by a midget. And then they do the reenactment, but they also do the interviews with the midget and also the people whose wedding was destroyed. So apparently this movie is a fictional movie, but then they cut in the interviews with, like, the parents of the real people who committed the crime. So they're the real parents to explain what happened. So the movie sounds like it could be interesting, but this trailer makes it sound terribly uninteresting. So I don't really know. Like, I don't have a feeling for this. Part of me is like, yeah, you're doing something different. But again, part of me is like, you're just doing a higher budget, higher quality version of what they do on the Learning Channel or the Discovery Channel. So there's just not enough to convince me, even though it's a poorer trailer as far as representing what the movie actually is. There's nothing in it to convince me to see this movie. Tackle.
Tackle.
Daniel?
I would watch Bridezilita. Yeah. But I won't watch this movie. I don't want to watch a bunch of losers do something dumb with their lives. Not a fan. None of the characters looked compelling. That would be the one reason to watch something like this, is if one of the characters is particularly interesting. None of them were interesting in this. They were all sort of loser high school kids who had no real self-esteem. And I'm not sure how that's going to be entertaining for any amount of time. So, tackle.
Tackle!
James?
This is funny because I actually felt as though the preview did a very good job at showing me what I was going to get with this movie, but then also didn't give anything away because you don't, there's no hint of how the heist ends up actually going down.
It doesn't. It does. Then, it fails.
Spoiler.
Okay. Well, thanks for spoiling it.
Well, I'm not going to watch this. If you read two things about the movie, that's the entire selling point of the movie is look at these stupid kids who tried to do a heist and it failed. And we're going to do this documentary slash retelling of it to explain the whole absurdity of it. That's the entire point of the movie.
I did not know that background context, and it definitely helps me make a judgment to know that that background context is available to anyone who thinks about this for longer than 2 minutes and 25 seconds, which is the length of the trailer. I don't know. I found some of the dramatic setting gripping, like, oh, do you want to be a loser? Or do you want to go out and do something like interesting with your life? Like that gripped me a little bit. And then just sort of, it seemed fast paced and all of that. But ultimately it was still a tackle, even with my misconceptions, because I don't find losers trying to make their lives interesting by doing something wrong that interesting. So tackle. Also, what's up with American blank? Like, is that just our new way of saying, like, people who, like, just this movie is about crazy people? Like, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, all of these movies that are American and then blank. I feel like we've reviewed a number of movies that have that set up.
Well, it's the continual, attempt, James, by these people who are trying to run our culture to undermine Americanism, because that's the last thing they have to undermine is our sense of life. Like we just said about the Simpsons still have the American sense of life where they think these people are absurd. So the battle is not lost, but that's what they have to undermine, is this idea of American elitism, or as they call it, American exceptionalism. They love calling it. And that's what they're doing here. That part that you keyed in on, this idea that, yeah, oh, we're losers, so we don't want to be losers, so we're just going to go do something with our lives, do something special. Well, the fact that it fails and they're trying to commit a crime and it fails and then we're going to talk about why it failed, well, that's undermining this idea. It's saying that it was destructive towards these kids to have this American exceptionalism. So they're blaming the narcissism that's been created by other things on American ideals.
God, double tackle and a fuck you.
But yes, that's why we continually have things that are called American, because that's what they're trying to do in general, is they think that's edgy. Is they think it's edgy to undermine those things. Oh, look at how smart I am.
Third trailer.
Dark Crimes is Jim Carrey's return. I don't know if he went anywhere or not. I mean, somebody can maybe tell me that. But it's definitely supposed to be like, hey, look, Jim Carrey's not a comedic actor anymore. He's very dark and serious. It's about Jim Carrey solving a murder crime in Eastern Europe by reading a murder mystery novelist book that very closely parallels the crimes. This trailer, for me, I was watching this and having just come back from Eastern Europe, I was like, were some of these scenes filmed inside Auschwitz? That's what it looked like it to me. It looked like it was in a gas, like where they have the body hanging in the gas, the room. It would look like a gas chamber. So I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I looked it up, and this movie was filmed in Poland. It was directed by somebody from Berlin who went to film school in Berlin. It was filmed in Krakow, Poland, and the director went to film school in Berlin. So all of what I was sensing was correct. It wasn't actually Auschwitz, but it was definitely that feeling, especially because Krakow is a very old medieval city. And it doesn't look like that at all. So he went to the extent, this director went to the extent to make this a very dark and depressing trailer. So everything I was saying about Europe is turned up. Everything I said about Europe last episode is turned up in this trailer. and that there's no way I would want to engage with this at all. Tackle.
Tackle.
Daniel?
Jim Carrey is not Robin Williams. And it is abundantly clear from this trailer. Tackle.
Tackle.
I actually, again, thought this was a good trailer. And the movie actually looks like a good movie. But it's just too trite and too dark. And too dark in a trite way. And too trite in a dark way. And every combination of that and Jim Carrey. Tackle.
Tackle. Final trailer.
The Meg.
Oi.
Is a... Don't. Hey.
The Meg.
Is about Jason Statham fighting a giant shark. The giantest shark that ever was giant sharks. You guys are all talking shit about this, but I'm going to say this right now. This is why I go to the movies, okay? This reminds me of the golden era of movie makings, the 1980s. We don't need anything else. We just need a giant shark attacking people, and we're going to fight back against that giant fucking shark. And then the soundtrack to this trailer, had you heard of that song when I sent it to you, Daniel, that artist?
No.
He's basically like doing a Frank Sinatra song, right? Beyond the Sea, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was done in the style of Frank Sinatra. And to juxtapose the absurdity of the trailer with that song was just great. The colorfulness of it, it was just a very enjoyable experience for me. I am all in on this movie. This is a gigantic hug for me.
Hug?
Daniel?
You may say that this harkens back to 1980s filmmaking, but I think this reeks of the 20-teens filmmaking, which is, hey, the 1980s had a good idea. Let's turn it up by 5,000% because we have no good ideas.
What if this you took Jaws and you just hit it with the reverse shrink ray machine that Chad Morris made or Ed Moranis made and just make it big?
Rick Moranis?
Yes.
That's what I meant.
You're talking about Honey, I Blew Up the Baby?
Honey, yes. I Blew Up the Shark.
That is what this is, essentially. What if the shark's jaws were, like, literally bigger? That'd be cool, right? Yeah. Justin, for someone who doesn't smoke weed, you like to watch a lot of movies that were conceived while someone was in totally high on pot.
It's so true. You want to know one of the first movies I ever thought was hysterical?
Ooh, what?
Now the name escapes me. It's Dave Chappelle, the stoner movie. What the fuck? Oh, I can't remember what it's called.
How High?
It's called... What, James?
How High?
Well, is that it with Bob Saget, where he's like, have you ever sucked dick for coke?
I don't know. That was a guess.
I'm going to look it up. You guys talk. So, Daniel, are you tackling this?
Stoner humor is Justin's bailiwig, which is ironic because he's straight edge, and also no one has said the word bailiwig since at least the early 70s. But I don't know. I just can't. This might be fun in the sort of Pacific Rim kind of way, but at least Pacific Rim was its own thing. This is Jaws. This is Jaws. That being said, if my wife wants to see it, I'll see it. So, reluctant hug?
Hug?
Yeah. And the movie is half-baked.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie. I'm not going to do what everybody thinks I'm going to do. And flip out, man, all I want to know is who's coming with me.
Is that Jim Brewer?
Yeah, very good.
What happened to Jim Brewer? Jim Brewer went the way of the dodo.
This is why I don't need to smoke weed, though. Like, I already find those things funny. Imagine what I would find funny if I was high.
Justin's life already finding those things funny and already binging on M&Ms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm perpetually high. I'm high on life, literally.
Yeah.
All right, James.
This movie let me put it this way. Let's imagine that I was actually 8 right now. Like, I was just born 21 years later than I actually was. And let's imagine that I'm just 8 right now. I see this trailer and I say, this is so cool. And I go watch the movie and I probably enjoy the hell out of it. Why? Because Jason Statham looks really cool and he's a submarine commander or something. And we fight a giant shark. That's so cool. But then I watch the movie 20 years later and I'm completely disappointed because I realized something. They didn't mean any of this. They weren't serious. When I was a kid, I would watch this movie and I'd be dead serious about it. I would say, this is really cool that the submarine captain is fighting the shark. But then I would look back as an adult and realize, oh, this was just a goddamn joke the entire time. I would feel like they were literally pissing on my childhood, like, or they were pissing on me as a kid, basically. Just they were tricking me. And I feel like this is probably what the Marvel movies
are.
By
R. Kelly. What's that? The movie was not directed by R. Kelly. Thank you.
I don't know who that is, but I guess he does
Google
stuff like
R.
that.
Kelly. Urine. That's all you'll need.
I'm shocked that you don't know who R. Kelly is. Jesus. So are you tackling or hugging this?
I'm tackling the shit out of this, and I kind of this gives me an aspect. This allows me to understand part of why, like, I don't like the Marvel movies is because if I was 8 and I watched the Marvel movies, I'd like those too, because I wouldn't be smart enough to I'd be too dumb to realize what was actually going on in the movies. I would take the Marvel movies seriously, as I'm sure a lot of little kids do. And then later when they grow up, they're going to realize, oh, it was just a big goddamn joke the whole time. They're not actually interested in heroism. Like, that's why I watched the movie. But when I look back, I realize, oh, it was just completely empty the whole time. I filled in all the aspects that I actually like. So tackle.
Did James trigger the 100% tackle rule?
Oh, did James tackle every trailer? James, did you tackle every trailer?
I tackled all of them.
So which one would you watch?
Oh, if I had
the 100% tackle rule is if you tackle every trailer, you have to say which one you would watch if you were forced to watch one.
Right. I would watch. I guess the Jim Carrey movie. The Dark Crimes movie, because it just looks like it's the most competently executed. With a close second of the shark, the Meg.
Also, if we're going to just start naming movies exactly what they are, in like a few years, a movie just going to be like, what's the South Park joke, Justin? Gay cowboys eating pudding?
Yeah. Well, they already did that. Remember when they did Cowboys and Aliens starring Daniel Craig?
It's true. But it's got to get even like,
and then the
it's
show,
get even
and then the
more,
show Vikings.
It's got to get even more honest than that, though. Like, studio ploy to wring more money out of dumb people. 2. Like, it's gotta get really honest.
I prefer another contrived situation to put Kevin Hart and The Rock in so you'll go to the theater.
That's right. I like it.
I mean, what about Skyscraper? It's just Skyscraper. Skyscraper, a.k.a. The Rock fights with a prosthetic leg.
Another brand-oriented movie to ruin your childhood and make us hundreds of millions of dollars. Yes.
Or, this is a friend of mine basically said this, I'm stealing his joke, but the new 3-hour Marvel trailer for the next 3-hour Marvel trailer.
Exactly. Need a little more honesty in our movie titling here. The Meg. Great.
I just want to know how mad Peter Griffin is about this movie.
I know. If it was a Family Guy spinoff movie, I'd be more likely to see it, actually.
All right, you all suck. But let's talk about something serious here. James has grown and changed a lot on the show, so let's have a little bit of a discussion about that. I got a lot to
short story. I've been interested in politics since I was 12. The reason I've always been interested in politics is because I understood that deep issues were being raised sometimes, if only tangentially, when people talked about politics. And that got me into that eventually got me into philosophy. Then I got into objectivism and really studied that and really started thinking deeply about philosophical issues. Fast forward to Trump. I didn't know what to think. I was very struck by an emotion when Trump was elected that I didn't understand. Now, as time goes on and I start moving away, and at least in my professional life, away from politics, like I'm now in my professional life, I'm completely dedicated to working on physics and epistemology and using epistemology as a means to understanding physics. Spending more and more time on those kinds of problems has allowed me to step back from politics and see it and realize when I talk to people about politics, no one is able to really listen. Everyone is so intensely confused on so many issues that it is that they might as well not even be listening to you. And the way I found it is this, is I talked to some of my uncles but it was my uncles were only the final straw on this. But talking to them, I almost came at it from the position of teaching, because I teach. And in teaching, you have to consider what your student knows and what they don't know. And you have to also consider what they're getting wrong. If the student is getting something wrong, you have to convince, you have to back them out of their confusions and then start moving them in the right direction. And in the realm of, and when I apply that mindset to talking to someone about politics, I become vividly aware of the infinitude of confusions they have. And it's finally become clear to me that the vast majority of people are so confused on political issues that politics is the last thing you want to talk to them about. Talk to them if you want to convince them to have more rational ideas, or even more importantly, if you just want to have a human connection with another person, talk to them about anything but politics. Talk to them about art, science, anything but politics. Because, and one way to quickly demonstrate this is I start telling a Trump supporter, like, hey, I know you want smaller government, but Trump doesn't stand for smaller government on principle. But they can't think in principles. They just say, like, oh, but look at all the good things he's doing. I don't know how to back someone out of that deep a confusion. And then if I'm talking to a liberal and I start making all these good points about capitalism, I can see by their body language that they're kind of just thinking, like, okay, yeah, he's making a lot of good points, but I know I can't end up on the same side as Trump. And of course you can't end up on the same side as Trump, but they're just so confused on the issue, you're never going to get through to them. I'm done with politics. I'm done thinking about it because our politics is so disconnected from reality. I'm done thinking about politics. I'm done trying to convince people. I'm completely moving my efforts towards physics. And I think and if you want to hear more about this, I can talk more about it, but my efforts to improve the culture will rest entirely in my work on physics and epistemology now. So that's the quickest I can do the summary.
Yeah. And I mean, that gives, several sort of directions to go in here, and there's a couple things, and I'll say both of them, and I think maybe Daniel may need to pipe up on one of them. But one of the things you said is, and this is the one I expect Daniel to sort of be the voice of reason here. One of the things you said is you can't talk to people about politics because they're so confused about politics that there's not even worth having a conversation. And then you name many other things that you could talk to them about. But my question is, and this is where I expect Daniel to sort of take the counterpoint, is if you're using that principle, can you really discuss anything with anyone? I mean, do you know how difficult it is for me with the way I approach sports to talk football with people. Like, yeah, I can have a very brief sort of surface level conversation, but then if I try to go any more in depth with people, it's just, there's no point in continuing the discussion. It's just like, okay, this is the conversation's useless. I mean, I remember one time, Daniel, we were at Busch Gardens, and a Steelers fan started talking to me about when Drew Bledsoe replaced Brady, and he was convinced it was the Steelers who knocked out Bledsoe to make Brady quarterback for the Patriots, when for a fact, it's the Jets. 100%, everyone knows that. But he just kept saying it over and over again. It was like, okay, I was nice to this guy at first, but now there's no point in the conversation continuing. But then that leads to my second thing I was going to ask. And this is the greater point. Is the purpose of conversation with every person you meet to convince them and change their minds? Isn't there something to be said for just sharing mutual enjoyment? Now, for me, how can I share mutual enjoyment of football with somebody who doesn't even know what they're talking about and they're confused? So that's where I have the problem. But is that what you're saying, that when you interact with people, your goal is to convince them and change their minds?
Well, you'll notice that when I said, like, if you're interested in improving the culture, the last place you should talk is politics. But in addition, I also said, if you just want to forge a human connection with someone, also the last thing you should talk about is politics, because they're too confused. Imagine talking to a Silicon Valley type. I could talk to them about computers. I can talk to them about science. I can talk to them about philosophy. I can talk to them about ethics, and probably really forge, not agree with them on everything, of course, but really forge some connections there. And in addition, improve them as a person and improve myself from their ideas, but not in politics. You know, imagine all of the insane things a Silicon Valley type person has that are great to deal with, and how insane the typical Silicon Valley person is in politics. So, you know, it's and like I said, it's just about forging a human connection. Like, the people are so savage and confused and barbaric in politics, that's the last place you want to interface with them if you just want to connect with someone. And as for as for people being confused on all the other issues, yeah, sure, there's confusions, but they're nowhere near that of politics. This person who's confused about football and you can't really connect with them, that's fine. Yeah, just don't talk to that guy. But I'm sure you can find plenty of people you can talk about football with. You know, and I know I can find plenty of people I can talk about science with, you know, and I disagree with them on a lot of things. But like, we're connecting. Like, I'm taking things they say and they're taking things I say, and we can be reasonable and civilized human beings, and we gain from one another. Not in politics. In politics, I find that it's either straight acrimony and misunderstanding, or the other person just pretending that they agree with you, or trying to make it seem to themselves as though they agree with you. Like, that those are the only options, and both are a waste of time. And all in addition, and this means something, and the reason I think it's worth talking about this, like, in a open forum like this, is because each individual has to make their own decision. I don't presume to know exactly how these things I'm noticing applies to other people's lives, but I suspect that progress in the objectivist movement will not be made in politics. We need to turn our canons of logic and evidence elsewhere. And I mean, and that's what I'm doing. I'm pointing it towards physics. And that's part of what made me realize this is what is my work in physics and epistemology.
Well, and that's something I want to be clear about. In regards to this show, though, I agree with objectivism, and by that sense, am technically an objectivist. I don't go around saying I'm an objectivist, and I don't go around saying the purpose of this podcast is to be part of the objectivist movement, or even the purpose of this podcast is to change the world. And that's the next sort of question I have for you in this sort of interview open forum. how does this translate to not just simply witnessing the farce with us, that you no longer even want to witness the farce of politics as we do in the news segment?
I really would like to interject before James answers.
Go ahead.
I've been sitting here holding my tongue, which is, so I guess my question for James would be like, what do you see as the purview of politics? Because it's interesting that in my day job, I have to deal somewhat with politics, although not as much as some might think. But in this show, while we might talk about political news, I don't think of this show as primarily a political show. I think of this show as primarily about ideas in general, and in particular, culture, pop culture, politics sometimes, but philosophy, art, the human experience, any number of things. But I don't think about this show in particular as a political show. I mean, we don't sit down and think about why Steve Scalise has to back Kevin McCarthy as the new speaker because of the several odds he'd be facing and convincing the rest of the Republican majority to support him over this guy who was the heir apparent before Paul Ryan got into the race.
What the fuck did you just say?
I don't know. Because who cares? That's the point, is I could have a show where we sat down and talked pure politics. But I don't think we do talk pure politics in this show. I think we use politics, or at least political stories, as a catalyst for talking about ideas, for talking about the culture, for talking about how people react to the culture, etc.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what you see as the purview of politics.
That's a good question, because it's clearly not as narrow as you just demonstrated by talking about Paul Ryan's succession. Incidentally, the only reason I knew Paul Ryan stepped down is because I saw it on a newspaper on a desk. Like, I've been so removed lately that, like, that is how I found out about that.
Sort of side point, that's an enormous story, certainly in politics. Yeah. One of the biggest, of the past 10 years. No one brought it up for consideration on the mid-side. I mean, and I'd probably
I don't mean that narrowly. I mean anything that's broadly construed in the public mind as being a political issue or related in an essential way to a political issue. For example, gender issues are now entirely within the purview of politics, even though you could like make an abstract sort of claim that it's like that's a it's like a metaphysical issue, but like it's politically charged now. So like anything that the culture now sees as related to politics, I generally think people are unable to reason about it because it has the taint of politics. Not that politics is, necessarily something one shouldn't think about. I just think politics is generally speaking a subject matter that the culture is so confused on that there is no headway to be made. I have no idea how to untangle the knot. So I'm going to cut it at a different point.
It's an interesting experience that you have, James, because I can't say that mine is necessarily the same. So, not to misquote Aristotle, but he said something to the effect of like when man is, he's the greatest animal of all when he's completed or something like that. But when he has separated himself from law and adjudication, he is the worst of all animals.
Yeah.
Which people sort of then misquote as like man is a political animal, which is sort of what he's saying. Anyway, point being, I tend to find, especially when I really narrowly tailor who it is I talk to, that politics tends to be an angle that I can get at deeper ideas with people because we sort of have a common, at least, pool of things that everyone has to deal with. Everyone has to deal with the fact that Hillary is the Democratic nominee and Trump is the Republican nominee, and has to deal with the fact that Trump wants to build a wall, and has to deal with the fact that we might bomb Syria, etc. And especially when I tailor who I talked about these things, and that being said, my job affords me the opportunity to talk to some of the most educated people on the planet, educated in a good way, not just in a cursory way, I find that I can make inroads with people via politics to get to deeper ideas about things. But certainly if I talk to, my extended family, like super extended family of politics, or strangers about politics, I don't necessarily have that same experience, but then I don't engage. But to be fair, I don't engage with them about anything. I don't care if they have to say about politics. I don't care what they have to say about movies. I don't care what they have to say about anything. My extent to the conversation I want to have with them is, thank you for the frappe. How much do I owe you? And then move on with my life.
People who are thinking, so yes, you're right. Politics in general provides, you know, the objectivist philosopher who's interested, or the objectivist who's interested in, you know, making the culture better, provides him with all these segues towards these broader issues. I think that bridge is now a bridge that's infested with so many corruptions that when you attempt to cross it, you get covered with all sorts of things that makes you completely unable to send your message to the person you're talking to.
You couldn't even say trolls.
We need to find other segues that are not as corrupted.
But it's a bridge that's infested with so many trolls.
Yeah, who want you to pay the troll toll.
Is that... Yeah.
So,
that's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, and maybe this is just my life, because, I mean, I'm still thinking about it, but I know I'm not interested. I've given serious thought to politics for so long, and I realized it doesn't do me any good anymore for connecting with people and just, you know, thinking about ideas that I think are relevant. I don't think responding to Trump or anyone the left is going to field, I don't think I have anything to learn about the world from thinking about any of the people who participate in politics, not even in a derivative kind of way anymore. It's just too separated from reality. Just to address any political conversation moves you too far away from reality for me to feel like I'm gaining anything personally. And I also don't feel like I'm advancing the cause of objectivism secondarily. So as a result, primarily what I'm going to do to pursue my life is this. I mean, this is what I do. This is what I'm going to do now. I mean, this is kind of an announcement too, like for like my life professionally. I use induction as formulated by David Harriman and Leonard Peikoff to explore physics. And what I just personally like doing is just understanding physics. And Leonard Peikoff has given us the strongest tool of scientific investigation in the history of science. I intend to use it in order to rewrite the last 100 years of science, which has gone, or the last 100 years of physics, which has gone astray. And I'm already starting to see results. I've already derived a certain aspect of relativity from quantum mechanics, which is supposed to be impossible. Those two fields don't connect with one another. So I'm already apparently getting some results from this inductive perspective. And my plan for myself is to continue thinking about science, which is what I really enjoy doing. And I can continue to fight the battle for the culture in this way, is if this inductive science project ends up being successful, ultimate success for my project would mean a unified physical theory, a theory of everything. It is looking possible at this point, there's a chance, and I need to follow up on that chance, that this one derivation I've made can lead to other ones that would unify all of physics into one theory. And if that is successful, that is something the community of scientists would be unable to ignore. In addition, in order to understand this new theory, they would have to understand Peikoff's theory of induction, because that's the only way they would be able to back themselves out of 100 years of faulty physics. As a result, my project would inject the objectivist epistemology into the top levels of our intellectual culture. And that's the way I plan on influencing the culture. So now that I see these pieces coming together for my life and how I can do things I really like doing, and in addition, I can continue fighting a battle for a better world for myself and others, like, politics seems irrelevant to me now. So,
well, to use a word, James, Godspeed. And could you hurry up?
Indeed, and we've definitely gone over our runtime. So I'm gonna cut this off here. What I am gonna say though, as sort of a final word, is I never designed the Midside, or I never designed this podcast as a vehicle for changing the culture. I really just want to laugh at shit and point out how stupid it is, and to find a place, create a place for other people to find where the stuff they laugh at and they think is stupid, they're not the only ones who feel that way, because I have in my life throughout it been made to feel like I was the only person who laughed at these things and found them stupid. And it's more focused on creating that refuge, that hideout for individuals rather than changing the culture. But, you know, sounds like you have a lot you want to focus on, and it's a lot of hard work. So I wish you luck on that. And, you know, I hope you achieve everything you want to achieve. For now, though, I think it's time to sort of put a button on this episode. What did you learn this trip, Daniel?
Man, anything I choose after the physics lesson from James is going to sound shallow. I learned that it's not guns that kill people, it's sharp knives.
James?
I mean, I guess what I learned has already sort of been stated is, you know, maybe I'm learning in the wrong direction, maybe it's wrong, but that's how I feel now about politics, and I guess I'm not... I no longer want to witness the farce. I want to avoid it and live life away from it, and then also do what I can to stop it.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that you people have no taste in movies, because The Meg is going to be the greatest movie in the history of movies.
That's unlikely, but I will eat my shoe if it happens, to borrow a tweet from someone. So, what did you learn this trip here in the Midside? You can let us know. Is James right? Are we right? Are we both right? Are we both wrong? False dichotomy bros? You can tell us on all the social medias, at the Midside. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Vero, at the Midside. Let us know what you think on this edition. Of the Midside, should we sort of culturally go galt and focus on what we want to do professionally? Is there another way? Is there something we haven't thought of? Let us know. Go to themidside.com/podcast to listen to all the previous episodes of the Midside, including some things we haven't mentioned in a while, like the Snyder series. Got to pick that back up again soon, right, when Snyder's next movie comes out. You can also listen to years and years and years of content and listen how we got snarkier and more curmudgeonly over time. You can also go to iTunes and Google Play and subscribe to get the latest episodes delivered directly to your phone, tablet, or other listening device. While you're there, give us 5 stars. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then one more to make 5 stars. Not hearts. We don't need your damn hearts. We need your stars. And then write a little note about the Midside that helps us move up the rankings. And then you can go to patreon.com/themidside, where you can choose to support us financially so we can buy things like microphones and new hosts. Yes, we will buy a new host if we have to. Gosh darn it.
That's a little weird considering we want a female host.
I forgot that point. It is a little weird. I probably wouldn't have said it if I had remembered that sexist point we made earlier, but I'm already fully committed. So here we go. If you can't afford to support us on Patreon, we understand times are tough, especially in the Trump economy, post-Syria bombing and market not doing well. So why don't you tell a friend about the show? In fact, tell some of James's friends about the show, since they're not going to hear about it anymore. So He has some friend openings who need to be told about the show. That's really the best thing you can do for us. It's the best thing you can do for the mid-side, for the mid-siders out there, for the mid-sider culture, is tell a friend. Tell a friend. So thanks very much, and until next week, see ya.
This concludes your journey into the mid-side. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a...